We are going to talk about how we can help reverse the decline of bumblebees this hour, specifically the rusty patched bumblebee, with a guest from the UW-Madison Arboretum who recently wrote about the issue for Scientific American. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We are going to talk about the recent placement of the rusty patched bumblebee on the endangered species list, why that matters, what it means, and what homeowners, gardeners, farmers, and you can do to help protect them. And we will welcome your questions and your actions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Susan Carpenter, the native plant gardener at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. She recently wrote in the Scientific American blog post, how to protect our disappearing bumblebees. Good morning, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Joy.
Well, first off, what is the rusty-patched bumblebee?
Well, the rusty-patched bumblebee is one of about 14 species of bumblebees that you might find in southern Wisconsin. And it's a very beautiful bee, medium-sized. The workers and the males have a small rusty patch. So when you look at the bee from the back, on the back side or the top side, you'll see a pattern of sort of stripes on the abdomen of the bee. And one of those stripes is yellow, and the first stripe is yellow, and the second stripe has a little rusty patch. So you can tell the bee pretty easily if you get a close-up view, and the best way really is to take a picture of it and then be able to study the pattern from the photos.
And we do have a photo of the rusty-patched bumblebee from your blog post. It's posted on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. The rusty-patched bumblebee recently became the first bumblebee to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. It's been put on the endangered species list. How significant is this?
Well, this is pretty significant. First of all, this bee has suffered a precipitous decline in recent years in its populations across its geographic range. So its range had been was a very common bee, seen often from the from this area out to the East Coast, up into Ontario, and then down on the south into the southeast part of the country. And now the eastern areas of the range are pretty well, it's pretty well not found in those areas anymore. And now it's restricted mainly to small populations within the upper Midwest.
And the UW Arboretum is
in
one of
that
them.
Range still, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, what do we know? Do we know why the populations have declined so fast?
Well, the rusty-patched bumblebee is not the only bumblebee that has had declining populations. With so many species, there are individual differences in how the species are faring now. So, we do know that there are multiple factors involved. Habitat is one of the big factors. So when habitat is lost or fragmented, then populations will tend to decline. And by habitat, I mean basically flowering resource, so places where flowers are growing. Other factors include disease and pathogens, and that has been shown for the rusty patch as a factor. Also, climate change is another factor, and pesticides is another big factor. So agricultural pesticides, insecticides that are used in the agricultural industry and in the horticultural industry now increasingly.
Mm-hmm. So why is this so concerning, that in particular the rusty-patched bumblebee is endangered?
Mm-hmm. Well, bumblebees are of all of our pollinators, and just to set the stage a little, we have about 400 to 500 kinds, species of pollinators in Wisconsin alone, native pollinators. And those are bees and other pollinators, but ranging in size from little tiny, tiny bees that may be very specialized on a certain plant at a certain time of year, short time of year, to the bumblebees, which are really large pollinators. They can fly long distance. They can, like several miles. They can pollinate early in the day and later in the day. They're very versatile pollinators. So they're doing a lot of pollination out in nature and for agriculture. So when we see declining populations of even several of those species, we see that indicates that something serious is going on. And this bee in particular, with the way that the range has contracted, has been a particular concern.
So, to be blunt, if the rusty patched bumblebee goes into extinction, why does that matter? What does that mean?
Well, what that may mean is that we have other bumblebees that are just a little ways behind it in that same situation. What it may mean is that we're losing capacity to pollinate and plants in native air, native plants in areas which are the basis of our food web. We see kind of a fraying of the basically life support that goes on with the natural systems that support life.
So what sorts of plants, including fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. does the rusty patch pollinate and
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question. There are many plants, quite a diversity of plants that they will use for bumblebees. We need to have, because they have very small colonies, and at this time of year, or shortly, we'll be seeing the queens emerge. And when the queens emerge, they are all by themselves. There's not a colony yet. So the queen has to establish a colony. She hatched last summer and mated last summer, and then has been overwintering underground throughout the winter. So once she comes out, she has to start a colony all by herself. And those bees will be emerging soon. They'll be feeding. First, they need nectar to support themselves, and they need to collect quite a bit of pollen. So they'll be using all the early blooming plants. In the woods, they'll be using spring wildflowers. They'll be using flowering trees such as Juneberry. They use some of our ornamental cherries, single-flowered ornamental cherries that have a lot of pollen to collect. They'll be using Creeping Charlie for nectar. It's very common to see them nectaring on Creeping Charlie. So they'll be using the spring-blooming plants. And then as the season continues and more plants come into bloom, they'll be shifting throughout the season to different plants as they come into bloom. And that's why having an assortment of native plants is very important, because there tends to be a kind of a parade of those plants blooming throughout the season.
So what we can do to help, for example, just by planting that Juneberry tree a couple of years ago, that was one way I can help the rusty patch bumblebee?
Yeah, well, there's other, and the bumblebees are not the only pollinators. As I said, there's so many species, and early in the season, we'll see some of the cellophane bees and some of the other, the Andrena bees, mining bees. These are bees that are solitary bees, so they don't have colonies at all, but they'll be out. And so I think one of the things that's neat about the pollinators and especially about bumblebees, because they're so big, is that once you start looking for them and documenting them, maybe with photography, you begin to see a lot of variety in them and appreciate the diversity that's there, that's kind of been under your nose the whole time as a gardener or landowner.
I could have some there and I don't even know it.
That's exactly right.
Let me, I think I have time before news for Steve in Montreal. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Morning.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a question here. When the area up here was really going strong, there was, to the east about 5-10 miles, a site referred to as the Bee Ranch. And I know up until a few years ago, I was going south of Hurley and pulled off the side of the road was a semi-load of beehives. And that's essentially woodland area there. There's a little farming, and the Guile flowage is there. But a semi-load of beehives?
I'm wondering if they were honeybees.
Yes. Yeah. You've brought up an interesting, something I haven't mentioned yet, and that is that the bees that I haven't even mentioned yet that are important for pollinating but that are not native bees are, of course, our honeybees. And honeybees, what you were seeing there was was a large group of honeybees. Now, honeybees have a perennial colony, and they're a domestic animal, basically, in this case. They're kept in hives, maintained in hives. Their health is looked after. And then they are often transported to different areas of the country.
And we'll hold it there for now because we do have news next from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll talk about how we can save the bees after the news. I'm Joy Curtin. This is the Ideas Network. The rusty-patched bumblebee recently became the first bumblebee placed on the endangered species list. We are talking with a native plant gardener from the UW-Madison Arboretum about what can be done to help this bee and other pollinators, and we are welcoming your questions and your concerns at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Curtin Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Curtin Show. Our guest is Susan Carpenter. She is the native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. She recently wrote a piece for Scientific American, How to Protect Our Disappearing Bumblebees. We heard from a caller just before our news break who was curious as to what he remembers seeing. He said some years ago it seemed to him that he would see truckloads of beehives being trucked around. And we were talking about how that was not the rusty patch bumblebee, that was probably a honeybee. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference and how many bees there actually are.
Okay, sure. Well, the honeybees, of course, are very well known because everyone knows about honey and the importance of pollinators in general. So honeybees are managed, and they are managed in large hives that last from year to year if all goes well. And these are the hives that are well known. People may have heard from these bees spend perhaps the winter in Texas or Florida. They're shipped out to California for the almond harvest, where they basically spend a few weeks just the almond pollination season. They pollinate the almonds, then they're shipped further up the coast. They may pollinate apples in Washington, be pollinating canola in Canada, and then circle back around. And so they often, or some of them will often, be trucked to the upper Midwest to spend some time in the summer. And at that time, they're not really pollinating a specific crop. They're not being brought in to pollinate a specific crop, but they may just be pollinating, they may just be out foraging on wildflowers. And this gives them some time to forage and to keep their colonies strong. And then they're shipped, of course, with the winter, they're shipped back down to their home. So those are obviously kind of domestic animals, domestic bees that are used to aid in those agricultural pursuits. But that's quite different from our native bees. The native bees are living in the landscape at all times, and they have their life cycle that allows them to overwinter when it's winter or to follow their own, whatever the life cycle is for that species. Some of them, as I said before, are just living for a few weeks. They may specialize on willow, for example. So they're just out when the willow's blooming, and the rest of the year they're underground, developing and turning into, developing into the adults to emerge the next year. So there's quite a bit of diversity in the bees and in the different life cycles that they have. The honeybees they can maintain themselves because they make honey in their hives. That is their way of maintaining themselves through times when there may not be flowers available in the landscape. And so we generally, as beekeepers, would take some honey out, harvest it out of the hives, and sell it or use it ourselves. But if you don't do that, then the bees just, that's just their own supply that they're using. We usually harvest off the excess. So bumblebees don't have that situation. They have their own small colony with very little storage capacity for resources when there's a bad weather day or something like that. But they have much smaller colonies. They're not managed colonies usually, except for bumblebees that are used in greenhouses.
Yeah. And as you mentioned in the first segment, but just to clarify that, the rusty-patched bumblebee will overwinter underground.
Yes. That's a very interesting life cycle. Right now, it's still, we haven't seen the bumblebees emerge yet in Wisconsin. So right now, the only living bumblebees are queens, or future queens, really, that were, they hatched last summer. They were born out of the colonies that existed last summer. They mated and they foraged a bit, and then they dug in underground into a shallow soil, and they went into a dormant state. So they're just waiting now. All the other bees from last year have died. The males, the workers, the queens from last year. And so just these new queens, these future queens, are waiting now to emerge.
That's fascinating. So, and we, weather permitting, they will emerge by mid-April.
Around mid-April is the kind of long-term average. Some years, if we have an exceptionally early spring and things start blooming and growing early, we'll see them earlier than that. I guess if it's very cold and snowy until the end of the month, then it will be later.
But as soon as that new queen emerges from underground, she wants some native plants.
Yes, and she'll use native plants as available, and she'll use some horticulture. Of course, some ornamental plants are good, you know, are useful and are, you know, are seemingly very attractive to bumblebees. But with ornamental plants, sometimes the breeding of the plant has led to like multiple petals, and then you don't see you don't have any pollen in those flowers. So, or perhaps nectar is not produced as much. So while those flowers are very attractive to us, they become somewhat less attractive or unattractive to bees. So paying attention to your plants and whether bees are using and visiting them is one way to kind of make a pollinator-friendly garden if you have a choice between something that doesn't attract pollinators and something that does. I always pick the plant that does.
We have a question about that, so we can go to Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. This came at a good time because last night I was going through my seed catalogs. I live in an apartment complex with lots of green space, and so I don't plant in ground, but I have about 30 containers. What inspired me was last year I received a gift, and the Latin name is ELZAFIRO. Capital R-I-E-G-G, and it was actually a shrub, but it was attracting bees. And so I would like to, that inspired me to plant in my containers this summer plants that annuals, herbs. Last year I even planted Monarda, and I don't care at the end of the season if I give it away. But what would you suggest for annuals, herbs, that I can, you know, buy from the greenhouse that will pollinate, that I can attract bees?
Okay, that's a great question. Depending on how big your containers are, I have known people to have success with planting some of the natives, like liatris, blazing star, some of those plants. But I think if you're growing exclusively in containers, and this would be, I wouldn't say this for just growing in a yard, but you might emphasize some of the herbs, because if they have some of the, like, oregano, other mints that bloom, those would be very attractive to bees. And they often have a somewhat continuous bloom, so they bloom over a long period of time, and you can keep... if you're doing deadheading and so forth, you can keep them blooming over a longer period of time. So I would suggest that for your container type gardening, because they're easy to care for and they don't need very, very large soil spaces for very, very deep roots like some of the prairie plants do.
Well, are there any other annuals like marigolds or zinnias that I can buy from the greenhouse?
I've noticed that zinnias can be quite attractive if you think about that upper that flower. It has actually a lot of small flowers blooming over time, and they're also, you'll also be attracting butterflies because they're a good nectar source for butterflies as well. One thing to mention about the nursery sourcing, if you're getting plants from nurseries, is please make sure that those plants have not been pre-treated ahead of time, and this could have been even when they were being first grown in the greenhouse that supplied the store. Make sure they're not being, that they have not been treated with any systemic insecticides. These are insecticides. One of the common classes is neonicotinoids, and these are insecticides which can be introduced at the very early stages of the plant, and they basically go into the plant tissue. They stay in the plant tissue over a long period of time. They end up in the flowers, in the nectar, in the pollen, and of course they prevent caterpillars and other insects from eating the plant, but they also can harm both those insects and also the pollinators. So it's very important to make sure that your nursery is not getting plants that have that incorporated into the plant already.
Thank you, Mary, for the call. Speaking of neonicotinoids, Rob in Ashland has a comment about that. Hi, Rob.
I was waiting for somebody to say the magic word. Every time I hear a discussion about the decline of yet another pollinator, whether you're talking about colony collapse disorder in honeybees or your rusty patch to bumblebee, or the decline in the number of monarch butterflies, or there's probably a dozen others that I don't know about. Nobody talks about that 900-pound gorilla in the corner of the room.
Well, we just did, Rob.
You're the first one. Everybody talks about every other possible problem with pollinators, but there's no Rachel Carlson screaming about neonicotinoid poisoning. And I'm told you can graph the increase in the use of neonicotinoid pesticides with the decline of these pollinators, and it matches one for one.
And neonicotinoids are used on a plant that you might get from a greenhouse to protect it from pests.
That's possible. I mean, they're used in agricultural uses, which I think is part of, I think that maybe one of the caller's points is they're widely used in agriculture. They're used to treat seeds before they're planted. Mm. So when those seeds are planted on a large scale, there can be the dust coming off, and at what time of year that would be happening. Of course, for thinking of bumblebees, that might be happening when the queens are out on their first foraging runs. So it is a problem. Some of those are applied sort of in anticipation of, in anticipation of insect infestation. So we might question that, is there a way to avoid that? So it is important in the, I was talking before about the horticultural industry, producing plants, and we want to make sure that the plants that we're purchasing with all good intention to help pollinators don't have a detriment, built into them. And I think, to be fair, there have been a lot of studies and a lot of information about the neonicotinoids. They are really, I think, if you think about kind of the four parts of a wheel, they are one of those four parts. And if we really of the factors that could be threatening to bees. So we talked about the four things earlier, and we can focus in on them and really look in at what what the issues are around them. We would find that some of the testing has been done using honeybees as a model as a model animal, and then we would learn that bumblebees and honeybees are not equivalent in their responses to those chemicals. There have been studies that show that. So then we need to really look at some, you know, really get into the details at that point.
And so the farmers typically in agricultural practice are using this neonicotinoid.
There's been a big increase in it over a time span. You know, there's a lot of information that's publicly available. A recent study, an international study, does have, you know, that's probably the most recent like summary of these data do have some, you know, really substantial substantial information about it. So I would, you know, I think it's important to realize that there are different factors, and they a given factor might be very important in a particular spot. Altogether, those factors are all important over the landscape, and we need to know more about all of it. But in the meantime, there's actions we take. We don't have to wait until we know exactly how harmful something is in order to be more precautionary about saving, you know, about protecting the bees.
And I do want to get into some more specifics on what we can do. But let me share Robert on Facebook, who says, I live in Russ County. Mm-hmm. I have 3 acres of lawn that I do not mow after the dandelions go to seed, as I have always left it for the bees. In the last few years, there were fewer and fewer bees. This last season, there were none, not one. I have a very big garden that is suffering the same fate. Cornfields on all sides of my land. What is not corn is soybeans. Everything is sprayed at least one time, if not two. The last 3 years, not even a potato bug. The only thing I see are some small flies around blossoms. We need to rethink our farming practices, and the sooner the better. Can you just generally speak to that as to whether farming practices being rethought would help the rusty patched bumblebee?
Well, I think the writer makes a very good point. In areas that are heavily agricultural, there's another piece of this that we haven't really talked about, and that is large scale agriculture is also using herbicide, of course, to control weeds. And weeds in the past have often been those plants, those flowering plants that aren't tended, that are in hedgerows and field edges, and even within the fields themselves to some extent. And those edges and margins were where the native bees of that area could still be hanging on. And with the herbicides eliminating that, those kinds of areas around a field, you know, plowed and planted right to the edge, then we've really kind of cut off the habitat that is there, plus the added effect perhaps of the insecticides that we were talking about earlier that may be used. The writer brings up a great point about lawns. And that is that in areas which perhaps aren't as surrounded by heavy agriculture as he has, the lawn itself, it can have good flowering resource throughout the summer. For example, clovers, even dandelions within the lawn are used by bees. And so if nothing else, having those available is a good resource in a lawn type situation, kind of a flowering lawn.
Yeah, I think the rusty patch bumblebee would love my lawn. All sorts of creeping Charlie and dandelions, and how about violets? I got a lot of those too.
Those are good too.
We will talk more about what we can do to help the bumblebees, specifically the rusty patched bumblebee, which was recently placed on the endangered species list. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. The
Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about how to save the rusty-patched bumblebee and other native pollinators with our guest, Susan Carpenter, the native plant gardener at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. She recently wrote a piece for the Scientific American blog, How to Protect Our Disappearing Bumblebees, which talks about the importance of the rusty-patched bumblebee, which was recently placed on the endangered species list. 1-800-642-1234. If you have an action that you take that you'd like to relay, or if you have a question for our guest about how to save the bees, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Phil on Facebook says, I have documented rusty-patched bumblebees on my Iowa pasture dairy just west of Prairie du Chien. Organic Valley dairy producers with a pasture requirement and organic farming should be an important part of the recovery of this species in southwest Wisconsin. So, Susan, is that right?
That is. And I'm glad that this person has let us know that, because that was a point that we haven't really talked about yet. Not all farms are created equal to, and in this area of the Midwest, which is in the remaining range of this bee and of many other bumblebees, we do have a lot of organic farming. And organic farming is going to be a kind of land management and land use that promotes the kinds of habitat, or would tend to promote the kind of habitat that is more that would be healthy habitat for pollinators and for bees. So I think that's a very important point. There are many farmers who are very supportive of of the kinds of practices that that would support our native populations.
Well, the subtitle on your piece was What We Can All Do to Help, including farmers. So what can farmers do to help save the rusty-patched bumblebee?
Well, I think farmers might want to be, farmers are aware of their land, and the farmers that I have met and that I, and who's, you know, who have spoken with us are very aware of the stewardship of their land. So I think that's really where they start. They know their land, and they know more about it, simply because when you pay attention to land, you learn about it, and you know it well. So that's a lesson really for all of us to spend a little more time learning what's right beneath our nose, if we're home gardeners or in a community garden setting, and farmers who are not using chemicals extensively, farmers who have a diversity of crops. I know organic farming is usually a more diverse set of crops being grown. So there are crops that do depend on pollinators there, and it behooves them to support pollinators in order to get squash, tomatoes, peppers, the fruit trees that we have here in Wisconsin, other market vegetables are all pollinated by insects, and it's important to have a healthy population of pollinators to support that agriculture as well.
Are you aware, by placing the rusty-patched bumblebee on the endangered species list, is that going to result in some maybe stricter regulations on the use of pesticides or other practices? Is the very fact that it's there going to force changes?
Well, there's the Fish and Wildlife Service has provided guidance on the implications of the listing. There are still there's still information about habitat that's coming, that's going to be available. I mean, we have a species here has a very restricted range now, and even in its range, it has very small populations. So this is one species. I think what would be important to think about now is to think about of course, supporting this species and documenting it as our as your listener did. And documenting it with photography is a great idea. And there's actually a tool online to report any sightings and upload your photographs. Then you have a map. There's a map of where the bee has been found. And this is a way for people to participate in documenting. And that website is called bumblebeewatch.org. And it was created by the Xerces Society, which is an invertebrate conservation group. And they're actually the conservation group which was responsible for petitioning for the listing of the species, because they had noticed the rapid decline and had brought the petition forward to the Fish and Wildlife Service in the first place. So that's an important tool, because it allows anyone to, first of all, begin to notice what's there, what they're living with, you know, what's living in their areas, and it can be used for any bumblebee species. So good photographs, upload them, enter a little bit of information, the date and so forth, and then we'll have better patterns, and people can contribute their observations.
So that this is the citizen scientist project that
it
we
is.
Can participate in.
Mm-hmm. That is a great way to participate. Mm-hmm.
So that's bumblebeewatch.org?
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, we'll post that also on the Joy Cardine
Perfect.
Show Facebook page. You had mentioned earlier that the UW Arboretum was kind of a citizen scientist type project. Is that related to this, or is
well,
that different?
Yes, we actually started our citizen science project in 2012 because the rusty patch had been spotted.
Yeah,
it was just fortuitous that we had learned from a bee expert that he had spotted it at the Arboretum. And he was asking if we had seen more of them. And we hadn't been paying, we hadn't been paying that much attention to our diversity of bumblebees. So we started a project. Citizen scientists have been taking pictures of the bumblebees and uploading those, and then taking pictures around Madison and taking pictures in other places. And so we've been able to learn a little bit more about where it lives, what plants it's using, what kinds of seasonal pattern it has, when does it emerge, when do the queens show up, the future queens in the summer. So it's really an interesting project. And if people are interested and they're in the Madison area, they can contact us at the UW Arboretum. We will be doing trainings coming up in the spring as the bees emerge, and they can learn how to participate.
Chris on Facebook says, I have read about bumblebee houses from old clay pots and have seen plans about that. Do they actually work?
Well, they actually don't work very well. It's an interesting idea, but actually for bumblebee, if you're creating or you want to have bumblebee habitat in your yard, the best things to do are to is to not destroy chipmunks and ground squirrels. They create burrows, and the bumblebees will use those old burrows. Bumblebees will use cracks in your foundation, and they'll go on in, or in an old building where there's a hole or opening, they'll go into there. They need a place about the size of a softball to make their colony. It's a very small colony. So they will maybe sometimes build a colony in a big flower pot that has a lot of plants in it. They might build a colony in compost. They're really resourceful about where they build their colonies, but some of them do prefer the underground colony. So they'll be in a burrow, as I said before, or maybe in a rock wall where there's some cavities behind there. And then you'll see them coming and going, and they're not aggressive, so they're really of no harm. And that colony will only last 1 year. So you don't mistake it for a yellow jacket or something like that. These bumblebees will just come and go, and the colony after 1 year will be complete.
Oh, mm-hmm. They're going to still love my house with all those chipmunk holes, too. And we have Matt in Wausau who emails, I plant a lot of native flowering plants, but with few exceptions, the white-tailed deer eat them right up, even to the point of digging through the snow to eat them. Are there any plants that are not only good for bees, but resistant to white-tailed deers? What role does the overabundance of deer play in the decline of pollinators?
Well, that's a great question. And out in the, we know the impact, and there's a huge, wonderful study of the impact studies, but one in particular done here at Wisconsin about the impact of deer, not just on eating the plants, but on the whole structure of the forest. So yes, deer have entirely shifted our native vegetation, and that can have a huge effect on pollinators. That said, there are still native plants in natural areas that are definitely, you know, where definitely the whole area is alive with bees. Especially in the spring, the woodland habitats are more important for bees and pollinators, and in the summer, more of the prairie areas. So it's also good to have a mixture across the landscape of these different kinds of habitats, so that there is always, you're always thinking about resource throughout that season. Deer can be a problem, especially in the winter, especially when there are many of them, and especially when they're hungry. I find at the Arboretum we do have a lot of deer, but they they're very attracted to novelty. So if new plants are going in, they come and explore every day. They try things and they nibble on them. After a while, they tend not to bother that area as much. So there's fencing is a solution. If that's not practical, I would say just if you have a slightly larger area, just plant it heavily with natives and do what you can to dissuade the deer from taking all your plants.
We have just a minute to go. Maybe a kind of a conclusion on how homeowners and just home gardeners can what can we do to help the bee?
Well, homeowners, think of these factors where we can have the most impact is planting a this flowering sequence that I've mentioned a couple of times through these plants that flower throughout the season, not a plant that flowers all season, but that the sequential flowering is fine. Plant plants that bees do like. Leave a little bit of a messy yard there, so you have these little areas where the bees can overwinter, or where they can nest, a little bit of soil or hollow logs and that kind of thing, if you can manage that. And then don't use the insecticides. Really, with the insecticides, what we think of the food web, and the caterpillars are eaten by birds. The bees are needed for pollination, so we need to keep those things intact.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Susan Carpenter, native plant gardener at the UW-Madison Arboretum. She recently wrote a piece for Scientific American, How to Protect Our Disappearing Bumblebees. Thanks to Brianne Chasso and to Naeja Ellison for producing the program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.